Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cagliano. How you doing, Frank?
Fit as a fiddle, young man. Fit as a fiddle.
Fit as a fiddle. Great. So it's now the end of July, which under the planned schedule for the year means we should have had the Democratic convention wrap up last week, and we should have had the Republican convention coming up in a few weeks. But as everyone knows, the expected schedule has been thrown in the trash, and the Democratic convention has basically gone online, and the Republican convention has been relocated, I guess, once and then more or less canceled. And so we thought this would be a good opportunity to talk about political conventions and, they're both their past and potentially their future.
I mean, it might be worth just noting, David, that just to get the narrative of this correct, that yes. So the Republican convention was meant to be in Charlotte.
Yes.
And then President Trump, who wanted a large outdoor – or sorry, large rally-like atmosphere, moved it to Jacksonville, Florida, because there were public health measures in place on social distancing and so forth in Charlotte. So he moved it to Jacksonville, Florida. The governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, invited him to come down and said it'll be great. Of course, in the meantime, and so what happened was the sort of big set piece events would be in Jacksonville, but the business of the convention would still be in Charlotte. In the meantime, the pandemic, of course, and unfortunately, has gotten much worse in the United States, particularly in places like Florida and including Florida. Mm. And as a result of that, it's no longer possible. The Trump and the Republican Party had to kind of bow to reality and acknowledge that it wouldn't be possible to hold this in Jacksonville either.
Right. In the past few days.
So, yeah.
And the Democrats were supposed to have theirs in mid-July, but then they sort of switched to an online format. And I think actually the platform committee is meeting now.
Well, for people who've been in Zoom and Teams meetings for the past 4 months, you can imagine how much fun attending the Democratic Platform Committee as a Zoom meeting would be.
I can't say I logged in to watch that one. But these events, the conventions were often, really an important part of the campaign season. It was really, when a lot of Americans started to actually pay attention to the race in a meaningful way, and it really sort of signaled the we had entered the home stretch, as it were, with the countdown to Election Day, which is less than 100 days away now.
That's right.
Which in 2020 time means nothing, because time doesn't work the same now as it used to. But let's sort of talk about the origins of these things. When do we have the first party convention, Frank?
Well, the kind of official date of the first party convention is 1808. Clever listeners and careful listeners will know there were presidential elections before that, and might wonder, well, how were candidates nominated prior to 1808? Candidates were nominated by the caucuses of the various factions or parties, mainly in Congress. It was not unlike a prime ministerial system almost, where the kind of party members, I'm using party advisedly, but the party members would get together and decide who their candidate was going to be. It was easy for the Federalists in the beginning because it would be George Washington as long as he wanted to do it. And then what we see with the election of 1800 and the emergence of the Jeffersonian Republicans or the Democratic Republicans in 1800 or their victory in 1800, that Federalists go into a long period of decline. Yet the Federalist Party are the ones who hold the first formal political convention in American history in 1808, when they nominate Charles Cotesworth Pinckney to be their nominee for president in 1808. And the Federalists hold national conventions, but I want to return to that in a second. They hold national conventions in 1808 and 1812 to nominate their candidates for president. So these are the first time, the 1808 and 1812 are the first times in American history that a political party, in this case the Federalists, meet in a convention, what they call a convention, to nominate candidates for president. I'm not sure these early conventions were much different than the caucuses that the parties held in the past. They may have been necessary, and I'm being I have tongue partially in cheek in here because to say that the Federalists were in such decline, they may not have had enough Congress men to hold a caucus. And so so these were
just, we need more people to make this look legitimate, right? So
yes.
We get some other people.
So these conventions were even like less legit than the caucuses, but these, but so they, the Federalists held these first caucuses, sorry, first conventions, excuse me, in 1800 and 1812. Interestingly, and you'll know this, David, the Federalists hold another convention, famously or infamously, in 1815 during the War of 1812 to discuss the War of 1812, and they hold this at. In Hartford, Connecticut, and it's known to history as the Hartford Convention, and it's usually marked as the first time a political party seriously discussed secession in American history, because the Federalists, again, at this point, they've lost three presidential elections in a row, and they're going on a fourth, and they're pretty outspoken in their opposition to the War of 1812, and they get together, the rump of the Federalist Party that's left in 1815 gets together and holds this convention in Hartford. It's quite an interesting the documents from the Hartford Convention are quite interesting, and the political discussions are very interesting, but they moot for the first time secession in American history, and this talk then is that New England should secede from the rest of the Union and form its own kind of Federalist-dominated republic. So we get the earliest conventions are the conventions at the very beginning of the 19th century. And then we jump forward. We're starting to get to your period now.
Yeah.
In 1824, I think we get the first kind of really fractious convention in 1824 when the Democratic Republicans, the old Jeffersonians, hold a convention, and the 1824 presidential election is really interesting, but there are multiple, if you will, favorite son candidates from different regions, and although the conventions the convention, I guess, nominated William Crawford from Georgia to be the party's presidential candidate. The rest of the party didn't agree, and there were competing factions and other candidates. And you can develop this if you like, but there's a complicated outcome that results in John Quincy Adams being elected president. And that's simplifying a very complicated story.
Yeah, in some ways, I think 1824 is the end of the sort of the old caucus system. And
you point out
that there's, hints at things that look like a party convention before that, but for most of the first 30 years of the Republic, the people who are picking the nominees for the parties, quote unquote factions, call them whatever you want to, is done, by congressional leaders who are sort of picking amongst themselves, oftentimes, who they're going to put forward as their candidate. In some ways, the sort of modern convention, or at least the 19th century modern convention, grows in part out of the sort of the ways in which the Democratic Party splits into various bits in 1824. But it also grows out of 1831, where you have this idea of a convention coming from the anti-Mason Party, which is the first third party in American history in some ways. Which has a convention to they didn't have anybody in Congress to have a caucus, but they had people at the state level and the local level who were supporters of the anti-Mason movement, and they wanted to run a presidential candidate in the following year, their convention in 1831 actually sort of leads the other parties to have conventions in 1832. So some people point to this 1831 anti-Mason party as sort of the first real presidential party convention.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that, because I think the earlier meetings by the Federalists, as I said, to some extent are caucuses, but caucuses for a party that happens to be out of power and doesn't have a whole lot of people to caucus. and I think one element that bears thinking about here, David, and we know that Jacksonian democracy is a problematic term. See Dan Feller in last week's episode. But the rise of so-called universal manhood suffrage, that is universal voting for white men, the removal of property requirements for white men to vote in the 1830s, coincides with the rise of a new version of a new, more popular version of politics, with all the usual qualifications, that requires mobilizing people, which makes conventions, I think, both possible, but one could even argue necessary as part of the kind of constellation of political institutions. You can't get the guys together in Congress to caucus, you know, at a boarding house and decide who the next candidate's going to be after in the 1830s anymore,
right?
Because you're trying to reach out to a broader electorate, I think.
And so I think you're exactly right. You know, this is sort of a, you know, the idea of getting together people from across the country and establishing, you know, who their candidate is. I mean, the pirate conventions did really two things in the 19th century. You know, they picked who the candidate was, and they decided what the party platform was. They established, okay, here's what our party stands for. And unlike, you know, today or 4 years ago, you know, when conventions are sort of rubber stamping something that's already been decided, you know, in the 19th century, the people came to these with you know, without a clear idea of who the candidate should be, and with, you know, the party platform both something taken very seriously and as, you know, something that they would debate in the convention. You know, and now conventions usually last 4 days. Sometimes we're lucky and we get them, they only last 3 days. In the 19th century, you know, they would last for potentially weeks at a time, you know, as they sort of wrestled with these issues of who to nominate and what the various planks of the platform would be.
Well, in 1924, it lasted 17 days and took the Democratic Convention lasted 17 days and took 103 ballots to nominate. I mean, they legitimately fought over who was not. No, they didn't legitimately fight. They contested the who the presidential nominee would be, and you know, it was up in the air as opposed to the kind of choreographed thing we get now.
To be sure, right? And you know, because I mean, obviously, this is an era before there are any primaries. You know, oftentimes the convention was held well in advance of the election, simply because it took time enough that time to sort of organize the parties, you know, and the convention would start without any sort of clear front runner. There are a number of cases in the 19th century where the person who ends up getting the nomination was not somebody who was necessarily the most important person in the party or the person who was considered the front runner going into the convention.
Yes. Can I ask you trivia? Because you normally ask me the trivia.
Oh, geez. Okay, good. All right.
So, but it's trivia, along but... these lines. Who's the first dark horse candidate? Do you know?
James K. Polk, 1844.
See, you're really good at this. Do you know where dark horse comes from?
That I do not know.
It's obviously from racing, but the phrase itself is first used by Benjamin Disraeli in his 1831 novel The Young Duke.
Ah, okay. That
so
I did
not. So a politician coined the phrase dark horse, which is interesting. Anyway, uh-huh. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that speaks to the fact that these were not the outcome was not preordained, and indeed it wasn't always clear who the main candidates were going to be.
Right. So, you know, and we have a number of these sort of dark horse nominees in the 19th century, many of whom end up winning. You know, Polk is usually sort of considered the first of these, but Franklin Pierce was also sort of a compromise candidate. Lincoln, in some ways, was a compromise candidate. Rutherford B. Hayes, Garfield, going to the 20th century. Harding, you know, wasn't a front runner going into the convention. You mentioned 1924. We might want to talk about that more. But there, they also end up after 100 whatever ballots with a compromise candidate because of sort of splits in the party.
David, could you talk a little bit about 1860? Because obviously the 1860 election is momentous for all kinds of reasons. But
oh,
I think
sure.
it's a good example of both how conventions operated in the 19th century. To some extent, it's a kind of archetypal example of that. And so I think it might help to unpack that a little bit.
Right. So there are four conventions in 1860. From memory, the first party to have their convention was the Democrats, who had their convention in Charleston, which is probably the worst place they could have picked to have the convention, because Charleston at the time was sort of the hotbed of Southern nationalism and sort of fire-eating politics. And the Democratic Party at the time was very much split over exactly how they were going to address slavery in the territories. Southern Democrats came into the convention and said, look, we want to have a national slave code. Northern Democrats said, if we go home with that, we're going to get lynched. They end up breaking up the convention without picking either a candidate or a establishing any kind of platform. They have a later convention, which I think is in Baltimore, and they end up splitting again and having two separate conventions on different sides of town, if memory serves correctly. And the Northern Democrats end up nominating Stephen Douglas. The Southern Democrats nominate Breckinridge. And so those are places where the convention, the outcome of the event convention actually sort of shaped the outcome of that particular party and ultimately led to the Civil War. The Republicans had their convention in Chicago, and after going through several ballots and considering a number of different candidates, ended up with Lincoln as their nominee. There's also a Constitutional Union Party, but they didn't do very well. One of the interesting things about conventions in the 19th century and the 1861 is sort of indicative of this. If you were thinking you're going to be nominated, you actually don't go to the convention. And the supposition being that the person holding the highest office shouldn't want the highest office, they should be sort of drafted into it, sort of like Cincinnatus or something. So Lincoln doesn't go to the convention, and that was sort of the common phenomenon for potential nominees for them not to attend and then sort of be notified by a guy on horseback or later by a guy on with a telegram. Or I guess eventually a
So why is
phone
that,
call.
David? Why don't they go?
I think the idea is that a true statesman is called to office by the people rather than campaigning for office. And so thinking about 1860, Lincoln basically doesn't leave his porch during that campaign. He doesn't go around the way candidates do today, giving speeches and what have you across the country. Part of it is a lot easier to go around the country now than it is then, but that mode of campaigning is largely an artifact of the 20th century.
And it's also a bit of a legacy from the earlier, the earliest days of the Republic when
Oh, sure.
you weren't meant to be seen to be too ambitious.
Sure, that's right.
Because to be ambitious was to lack the virtue necessary to actually fulfill the obligations of the office effectively.
I mean, one of the things we think of when we think of party conventions today, or not today, recently, is that, the acceptance speech where the candidate accepts the nomination. Do you know when the first, since we're playing trivia, do you know when the first acceptance speech is?
I do not. You're better at trivia than I am.
Oh,
Sorry, I don't know.
it's FDR 1932.
Really? So what happened before 1932?
That
They just
the party voted on who the nominee was, and they gave and he was the nominee.
So when Lincoln gets nominated in 1860 and he's sitting on his porch, either literally or metaphorically, he
Yes.
doesn't go in at the end to even acknowledge the
No,
nomination.
he's in an entirely different part of Illinois at the time. He's
Right,
out in
okay.
Springfield, they're up in Chicago. He gets the guy and he's on horseback and he says, "Thank you, I'm very honored."
So it's not even the fiction that we have in recent years where they stay in the hotel until the night of that they turn up to give their acceptance speech
Yeah, no,
in the Met.
this is it's they were literally sort of not there.
So Joe Biden with his so-called basement campaign sitting in his basement, and that's not really what he's doing. That would be perfect. He'd be perfect. We're back to the future.
Exactly. Well, he's an old-fashioned kind of candidate in some ways. That's not
Well,
necessarily the way most people
sorry, he's
think,
remembering the presidential campaigns of
but
his youth.
oh man,
was an unfair shot. That was sorry.
it's not. He's a student of American political history. But a lot of the things that the other thing that they actually decide at these camp at the conventions was non was the platform, and the platform really mattered a lot, and people have had serious fights about what the platform was. Now, I don't think anybody actually reads the platform in any great detail.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I think it's akin to today is In the UK, all the major parties have a have an annual conference, usually in September. And those and party conference season is quite interesting because they will argue over the party manifesto in a way that Americans used to argue about their platforms, but as you're absolutely right, they don't anymore. And so I think there are echoes of in the kind of debates over manifestos in UK party conferences in the way Americans used to argue about their platforms. Because you're right, it was at one time a very big deal, and today isn't. Although I would say, do you remember the 2016 Republican platform? You probably don't, because this one was no.
They had some things
But
with
there.
Israel and other kinds of things that they tweaked
And
in weird ways.
they changed the language about Russia and Ukraine. This all came out in Paul Manafort's trial, in ways that, of course, and the Mueller report, in ways that were quite revealing, frankly. So it is interesting that when Trump kind of emerged triumphant in the Republican Party, one of the things he and his supporters did, more likely his supporters than him, did was actually try to change the party platform in meaningful ways, and in ways that I guess were commented on at the time, but I don't think the importance of him, of those changes was appreciated at the time because, as you rightly said a minute ago, we don't take party platforms that seriously anymore.
I mean, sort of the one that jumps out to me is in 1912, the Democratic Party platform said that the Democratic, who they ended up nominating Woodrow Wilson, they said that the Democratic Party candidate would only serve one term and would push for a constitutional amendment to only have presidents only serve one term.
Huh.
And Woodrow Wilson's like, yeah, that doesn't matter. And politicians today, for the most part, aren't bound by any meaningful way by platform, and they haven't been for a very long time. Although people have, fought over tariffs and currency and prohibition and more recently abortion, pretty extensively in these platform fights.
But to some extent, platform fights are, if you're going to occupy 4 days at a party convention, you have to do something, especially now that these things are often preordained. The outcomes are preordained as far as nominating the candidates. So to some extent,
What are you
that's
going to
what
do for
they do.
4 days?
They fight over the platform.
Well, one of
In Jacksonville.
in Jackson, yeah. Which, but I mean, one of the sort of quirks of this particular weird election year is that the Republicans at one point earlier this summer said, "Oh, we'll just keep the platform from last year or from last election," until people pointed out the platform from last election. The language of it said, "We criticize the president for all of these various things for." Not being responsible in office when that made sense in 2016 when the president they were criticizing was Obama. But if you actually read it in 2020, it sounds like they're criticizing the sitting president. And so they've decided to edit it now that people have pointed out the folly of just sort of photocopying their old platform. The other thing that often happened in conventions, or that did happen in conventions, not often, but actually always, is actually that's where the party picked the vice presidential nominee. We often think of the candidate picking who their running mate is, but that's actually a relatively recent innovation. What used to happen in party conventions is after they nominated the candidate for president, they would nominate who the vice presidential candidate was, and that was not necessarily a choice that the person at the top of the ticket agreed with or approved of. There are exceptions to that and important exceptions to that, but it's not actually until 1940 that the president, the person at the top of the ticket, really takes an active role in picking who the person at the bottom of the ticket is. And I think that's another ways in which this was a kind of institution that until the 20th century really had a real role in shaping the outcome of the election.
Which makes sense in the context of a system in which the party members who are attending the convention are actually choosing the candidate for president, and that person may not know whether they're going to be, you know, it's unclear who's going to win in these fights, as you suggested earlier, and therefore it would be presumptuous and indeed impossible for somebody to pick a running mate at that stage, because they don't know they're going to be the nominee, and the person who would emerge as the running mate often might be one of the other candidates for president, right? Who, right. You know, in other words, as these factions are deciding who's are sorting all this out, the to be dominated for the nomination for vice president would be, if you will, a consolation prize. So they can't really preordain it, can they?
Right. And, you know, the 1941 sort of a weird case where, you know, FDR is running for reelection a third time and he really wanted a new vice president. And he basically told the Democratic Party, like, look, here's who I want as my vice president. I want Henry Wallace. I don't want Jack Garner anymore. And they said, fine. And I think in Stevenson, when he ran, in the second time Stevenson ran for president in 56, he basically told the Democratic Party, yeah, pick whoever you want for my vice presidential candidate. You know, so that he sort of went back to the tradition of having the party nominate the candidate for him.
Yeah, but if memory serves, when Nixon was nominated in 52 for the Republicans, I mean, Eisenhower sort of just shrugged and said, okay. You know, but the party decided at the convention, and there was some to-ing and fro-ing during the convention itself about who the nominee for vice president would be.
All right. And until the 1980s, really, the convention was the place where candidates announced who their running mate was going to be. So, and since then, people have tended to not announce, usually 3 or 4 days before the convention, who their running mate's going to be. And we'll probably have an episode later on vice presidential, you know, running mates. But
the custom has been,
at least in the past couple of decades, to announce the person, usually between 3 and 7 days before the convention. You mentioned 52, and 52 is an interesting sort of turning point thinking about what these conventions are, because that's when conventions start to be televised. And I think that really sort of changes the nature of what these conventions are and the ways in which they work. Because up to that point, the only people who knew really what was going on in the convention were people who were on the ground as delegates to the convention. Now, we haven't really talked about delegates. Maybe we'll talk about that in a minute. But sort of the process of televising these conventions, I think, has really sort of changed the nature of what they are into the kind of campaign events that they've become. The parties have realized that this is not just a place for them to do their business and pick their candidate and establish their platform, but also a place to sort of showcase who they are as a party. Hence, you know.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think once you introduce, I mean, there was radio coverage previously, but you know, most of what goes on at political conventions is not terribly compelling or that interesting to a massive audience. But the introduction of television changes the nature of these events and makes them, if you will, important set pieces as part of the campaign. And so that changes the nature of them, but also increasingly makes them, if you will, unmoors them from their original purpose. Yeah, to the point where today, I mean, they formally nominate candidates at conventions, but that's really a formality.
Yeah, it's extraordinarily scripted. You know, they've got musical acts. They've got more balloons than, you know.
They're really boring.
Yeah, they are. And I think they do that on, well, I mean, that's it's tricky because the last exciting convention, and I get excited by conventions, so maybe I'm not the right target audience here. But, you know, the last really exciting convention was the 68 convention for the Democrats.
Yeah, and that was a little too exciting for them.
And that was, you know, and you know, I think as most, we've talked about 68 before in the show, but, you know, that's a convention in which they come in not really knowing who their nominee is going to be. They're going to have all these fights over both the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement, and riots happening in the streets outside the conventions and fist fights happening on the floor of the convention hall, you know, and the Democratic Party looked really bad on TV, looked really bad on the ground too, but I think it's the sort of televised aspect of that that made it look particularly damaging, you know. And I think since then, parties have tried very hard to make these conventions as boring as possible, while at the same time trying to make them entertaining as possible so that people actually watch.
Well, I think what happens in 68 is what we see, David, is if this is a story of democratization with a small d, right? Conventions become necessary once you get the beginning of something approximating mass politics in the 1830s, again, with all the usual qualifiers. And that works more or less for a century or so. However, conventions are the ultimate smoke-filled rooms, and the 1924 convention's a good Democratic convention's a good case in point, where the party really struggled to come up with a nominee because the party was factionalized between sort of a southern faction and a non-southern faction, and wets and dry, all kinds of things, and the KKK. It's a mess in 1924, and they end up in this pretty awful situation for 17 days and 103 ballots. But 1924, if you will, is the last of the old 19th century style conventions, because beginning during the Progressive Era, we see the introduction of primaries and various reforms to increase the democratization of the political process. And that we see the kind of culmination of that, I suppose, or of the, or sorry, the conflict between the two systems in 1968, where, you know, Hubert Humphrey had no primary victories. I don't think he actually entered any primaries. And Eugene McCarthy emerged as the candidate who had the most delegates who, as a result of the primary system. And so you saw this among many things in 1968. There was a culture clash between the old way of doing things and the emerging new way of doing things. And after 1968, you know, by 1972, the Democrats in particular, but also the Republicans, say, okay, we're going to do almost everything via primaries and caucuses, but mainly primaries. And once they commit to that, it makes the convention itself as a deliberative body to choose a candidate irrelevant. And therefore, it's really important as a campaign event, a television event. And that's why the nominating speeches are what are important, and really not much else. That's a kind of big picture view, but I don't know if you
Yeah.
get that
Well,
analysis or not.
yeah, no, I think that's right. And you know, one of the things I think actually you've seen in recent years is, you know, there was a point in which after Chicago, or and before Chicago, you know, television networks would broadcast all 3 or 4 days of these things nonstop, and that's what was on, and you know, there's only three channels, so that's what you watch. You know, one, since the sort of the actual decision-making process is sort of been taken away from the convention, you know, lots of television networks are basically not airing them. I think Ted Koppel at one point in the 90s said, like, this is just a big commercial. We're not doing this anymore. And so I think there's been a step away from conventions as sort of the thing everybody was paying attention to for that, you know, 3 or 4 days. You know, the other moment that I think is really important in conventions, thinking about sort of the role of primaries, is in 1912, which is, you know, the primary system had only started in a few states at that point, but in the primaries, the Republican primaries that year, Teddy Roosevelt won pretty handily over William Howard Taft, who was the sitting president. But when it came to the convention, the delegates sided with Taft, you know, and that led to Teddy Roosevelt founding his own party for a few weeks, or one election cycle, as it were. You know, and I think that sort of spoke to the sort of this tension between the sort of new way of doing things through primaries and the old way of doing things through sort of party bigwigs, who are the delegates. We haven't really talked about delegates, who are actually people that are doing the voting in these conventions. How important are these delegates, Frank, and who are they?
Well, again, it depends on when you're talking about. They're often, you know, they are party supporters, and they're the people who, they're often local officials, they're local office holders, sometimes they're state office holders. I mean, they're or national office holders, but they are the rank and file people who, you know, are active party members party supporters, party donors who make things, they make political parties work. And it's, I mean, it was interesting in the news coverage about the now canceled Republican convention in Jacksonville. There was a lot of coverage in the past month about who was going to go and who wasn't. And a lot of senior party members were saying, we're not going. And I'm talking Susan Collins, for example, senator from Maine, who has electoral reasons for trying to distance herself from Trump. But also, there were a number of people who said, no, for health reasons, we're not going. Whereas I was reading reports from sort of local office holders. I can't remember the guy's name or his actual office, but it was somebody who was profiled in the New York Times, I think from Wyoming, who said, no, it's my duty to go. And, I've gone to every Republican convention since, I don't know, 1984 or something. And he said, I'm definitely not going to miss it. And so these are often, I mean, they wear silly hats. But they're often quite inspiring because these are the people who kind of, they are the foot soldiers of American democracy, and they really make it operate in many regards. And so to some extent, they're quite admirable people. Have you ever attended a political convention?
I have not.
I attended the
I've been in
Massachusetts.
cities where they've happened and sort of seen the detritus outside, but I've not actually attended in person.
I attended the Massachusetts Democratic Convention in 1983. In Worcester, and it's a very interesting experience. It's a very interesting experience to go to a political convention. And this was a state convention, not a national convention. But the people who were there really, really, really care about their political party. That was my takeaway. And
Especially Democrats in Massachusetts.
yeah, well, yes. I went to the Party Congress in Massachusetts, the People's Party Congress in Massachusetts. But yeah, no, I don't know. What do you have to say about delegates there?
Well, I mean, it's in the 19th century, it was, often these sort of, local elected officials, people who actually, held some kind of office on their own or held some position of power within the party. Increasingly, though, what's happened is it's kind of an honorific that people get, often for donating money to parties. So sometimes it's, local state officials, but it's also sometimes, donors who end up as delegates. And party rules have evolved in various ways over the years to bind delegates to particular candidates and what how much actual freedom they have at the convention to make choices about who they're going to vote for. And sometimes the rules for that vary from state to state. I mean, I remember in 2016 when the Republican establishment was in a panic over the impending Trump nomination, and there were various people who were sort of scheming out various ways in which the convention could end up with a different nominee than Trump by liberating certain delegates to do different things. The Democratic Party, the two parties have slightly different structures about how they pick how many delegates they have for different states. The Democratic Party has these things called super delegates, which are people who are party leaders of various kinds but aren't actually a part of the delegations from various states, and they get to choose for themselves who they're going to vote for. They're not bound by anything, whereas most of the state delegates are. They've got delegates from places that aren't states, so territories often have delegations, and they get to vote in the convention, but they don't get to vote in the actual election itself. So they're interesting, politics right now about who gets to be a delegate and who doesn't. But it's in some ways lost much of its meaning because the convention itself has lost much of the meaning. Right, Frank. So now we're 2020. This whole year has been a, an asterisk for everything. Are we going to go back to the convention system in 4 years' time, or is this going to be a turning point where people are sort of done with this thing?
That's an excellent question. I mean, in many ways, what I find most interesting about the pandemic is what comes next in terms of, well, no, because whether it's the way we do our jobs, the way we teach, the way we record this podcast, all kinds of things are different than they were 4 months ago. And I'm just fascinated by the question of the variants of the question you've just posed. You know, what things that we used to do are we not going to do this anymore? And it seems to me the political conventions are, notwithstanding the kind of fever dreams of political journalists that there'll be a, you know, there'll be a contested convention and this convention's going to be really exciting. It doesn't happen anymore. The nomination fights are decided in the primaries and the caucuses, and that really calls into question whether it's necessary to have these events, apart from having a big set piece speech to unveil the candidate and his running mate or her running mate and have the candidate give a big speech. Well, you can do that on TV. You don't need 4 days of nonsense around it and the expenses associated with it. So I do wonder whether conventions this will be the death knell for political conventions, certainly as we have had them in the past. Having said that, you know, political parties are imagined communities in many respects, and they have to come together and they have to celebrate their identity in some way. And these conventions serve an important purpose in that way, I guess. And the convention speeches I keep thinking about that I've thought about recently, the ones that really resonate are Barack Obama's in 2004, which really launched his career and set him up to run in 2008, and Bill Clinton's in 1988, where he nearly ruined his political career because he talked so long. But so conventions have served an important purpose as far as identifying new talent. So there may be an impulse to keep them for that kind of reason, but it seems to me they serve no real clear and important function anymore, especially in a digital age. And depending on how this campaign unfolds, I'm not sure conventions will survive, and they certainly won't survive. I don't think they'll survive in their current, and by current I mean 2016 form. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I'm with you that they don't serve any purpose. Meaningful purpose anymore. But the sort of structure of the political system is so conservative that I could see them reinstituting them again in 2024, if we make it that far. You know, in as much as there's sort of ways in which the sort of structures of politics are embedded within the convention. You know, there's things with campaign finance law where the money you spend before the convention versus the money you spend after the convention count differently. You know, if you don't have a convention, then like, how does that work? I would like to see a sort of new version of whatever these things are, because 4 days of trite speeches, by various party members, isn't as enthralling as the parties may think it is.
I think even they realize that. But on the other hand, there's a desire to reward loyal party members. There are, yeah, I have a feeling that political conventions are probably quite fun. If you know, the fringe around the conventions is probably a lot of fun for political junkies. They're almost like trade conventions or shows, you know. We might well ask David, will academic conferences survive this pandemic? This kind of continues on last week's episode, and because they're not dissimilar in their form and function.
The book called the Republican National Convention must be exciting.
But seriously, and people look forward to them, even if outsiders don't quite get it. I imagine they probably will survive in some form, although this would be an interesting moment to rethink the whole genre. It's going to be very interesting to see how things unfold in the next month and how the Democrats and Republicans actually try to do this online. Because you can't have – I mean, what would be perfect would be if, you know, when Joe Biden starts to speak – and I'm choosing Biden because the knock on him is allegedly that he's, you know, so old. You know, if he's on mute or he hasn't unmuted himself when he starts talking.
I'm hoping he has people to help
like
him
that.
With that.
I'm but, sure he will. I mean, I know they won't screw up like that. But you know, I'm chairing a meeting later this afternoon. I'll probably start on mute. So I say that with complete sympathy. I don't know what. I'm going to be very interested to see how they handle this in the next couple of we in the next few weeks, actually, because both parties will be doing it, and they'll have to employ technology because they really want to generate enthusiasm. And I can see the narrative either way in the press. If one handles it better than the other, then the narrative will either be, you know, the Democrats are really motivated and they've got their act together and they understand technology, or, oh, don't underestimate Trump. This is the beginning of the comeback. They've really, you know, they've invested a lot in technology and they pivoted in a few weeks' time and put together a really successful convention, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
I mean, likely they're just going to be really dull online events, and the speeches will be what the speeches are. And if you like either candidate, you'll respond accordingly. Yeah. But it would be interesting if one, either of the parties handles it considerably better than the other, how that gets spun in the press, I think. I think that would that'll be something to watch out for.
This will be an election where I think future historians and political scientists will have a field day trying to figure out who made the right choices. You know,
yes,
when the Democrats
true.
When the Democrats first announced they were doing an online sort of hybrid convention a few months ago, people mocked them and said, "Well, that's stupid." But now that looks like that was the much smarter option, considering what's happened with the Republican convention or the two Republican pseudo conventions.
That's right, and we'll see whether they made use of that 3 months where they knew they were doing something online to organize it, or whether the Republicans trying to throw something together in 3 weeks pays off.
Yes. All right. Time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
I would like to endorse a podcast, David, which I listened to. There are only 4 episodes, so it's a kind of freestanding thing called, from the LA Times, called It Was Simple. And it's about the Betty Broderick murder trial in the early 1990s. Betty Broderick shot her ex-husband and his new young wife in 1989. And the podcast is excellent. This was apparently, and I was a fully functional adult in 1989. Well, to the extent that I'm a fully functional adult at all. But I have no recollection of this story, even though...
I don't either, but I was 12.
She was in... All right. Yes, David, you've made your point.
Sorry.
It's okay. You're not as young as you think you are.
I appreciate that every day, looking in the mirror. Yeah.
They make you know, she was interviewed on Oprah several times, Betty Broderick, this woman who was convicted of murdering her ex-husband and his wife in La Jolla, California. And it was a kind of cause célèbre. In the podcast, they say it was kind of the O.J. trial before the O.J. trial. Again, I have no recollection of this. So on one hand, I enjoyed it because it was freestanding. It's only 4 episodes. Secondly, it's a fascinating story, and I knew nothing about it, even though this was one of the signal event, cultural events of my lifetime, apparently. But also, it gives a great insight into the kind of social and legal and cultural history of the 70s and 80s. So I can, if you're looking for a short podcast to listen to, I can recommend It Was Simple from the LA Times.
LA Times. Great.
Yeah. What about you, David?
Well, I want to sort of draw attention to a news story that I think went under the radar for a lot of people, but actually might end up reshaping how we understand the earliest phases of American history, if that's the right phrase for it. It's an archaeological excavation that was just published in Nature. That seems to suggest that the earliest humans inhabited North America 33,000 years ago, which is about 10,000 years prior to the last oldest estimate.
Yeah, as the guy who normally has to lecture on this in our survey course, this is my so I've got to revisit my lectures again.
Yes.
We're going earlier. Okay.
Well, and in some ways, I think this is, you know, this story sort of builds on a number of similar kinds of stories that have gone back for the past couple of decades, where the traditional date for the first peoples in the Americas is the Clovis point that was found in the 40s, and that's 12,000 years old, and people go on the land bridge hunting the bison and what have you, and people sort of pushed back dates earlier and earlier than that as new archaeological finds have come forward. What makes this one interesting to me is this actually puts it back before the land bridge, which means that we sort of have to so it's not just like, oh, it was an earlier land bridge. This is actually suggests that people, the sort of population narrative that we have is radically incomplete. Assuming, of course, that the dates that they have hold up to scrutiny and whatnot, which is, I guess, a outside of our field of expertise, but yeah, I just sort of we're new finds are making us rethink the whole sort of narrative of how the Americas are populated.
Fascinating. Have they done so? They've obviously done some sort of testing to kind of get the age of these remains, but have
Well,
they done?
it's actually the it's tools they've found, and they've
Okay.
done sort of carbon dating of things in the sediment in this cave, and it's in this very remote cave on the top of a cliff or side of a cliff in Mexico. So it seems like it's a very hard place to get to, but that there were sort of several centuries, if not millennia, of human occupation there.
Interesting, but I guess what I'm asking, so they have they found remains or have they only found tools?
It looks like they've only found tools.
Okay, all right, sorry, because if they had remains, I mean, also doing genetic testing and finding the origin of the individuals would be interesting,
Be
but
interesting, right?
yeah, but I'm sure they've thought of that.
Yes, they are that they're smart people, these archaeologists,
They are.
when
They
they
are.
find
They don't need need our advice.
but yeah, you're gonna need to rewrite your lecture for as one often does for these kinds of
Yes,
things,
as
so.
one should, and undoubtedly in the future, I might be delivering that lecture online anyway, like Joe Biden and Donald Trump giving their convention addresses.
All right. Until next week, Frank.
All
Cheers.
right, David, cheers. Nice.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.